The only thing I was afraid of was the constant feeling of hunger. Hunger was always there. You go to bed hungry, you wake up hungry, and during the day you are hungry. I thought I would never get enough to eat.
Wait, so you're telling me that 1,136 days you were beaten and only 2 days not?
Well, yes. Every day, there was almost no, even a day when we were not beaten during morning checkups, so we were beaten all the time.
So what kind of conditions you call to be conductive for tuberculosis?
Perfect, comfortable conditions for it. For example, mold on the walls, high humidity all the time.
Each story we share in the True War Crime podcast is unique in its own way, although it is essentially related to one topic that we are talking about. Today, my guest is Mykola Aivalaki. He spent 1,138 days in Russian captivity. And along today's conversation, most likely at the end, we will focus a little more on the guards. We will try to see what they talked about, the ideas, why they did what they did, and about the ones he met on his way. Hello, Mykola. Glad to see you. Ivy decided to begin the conversation with you starting from the end of your prison story. Usually, I start at the beginning, like how did you get into captivity and so on. But in your case, let's start from the end. When you came back, like for the first week or two, maybe a month, you finally got your freedom. What did you want the most? What did you lack the most in captivity?
Actually, there was a lack of everything. There were any kind limitations, like for everything. So I just wanted to walk. I wanted to be, you know, next to people to communicate. First week after my return was kind of closed. We were in quarantine. We were not allowed to walk around the territory and we could not go out into the city. But after that week, our relatives could already visit us. My relatives arrived to me from Slovakia for the first time. I went to the station to meet them. And even this small walk made me feel so good just being next to people. If we talk about food, there was almost too salt in meals in prison. There were no fruits, no sweets. On the first day, it's my mistake. I probably ate half a liter of condensed sweet milk. Obviously, I got sick after that. So they put me on a diet and I got better in several days. But one of the hardest thing in there was lack of communication because we were not allowed to communicate in the cell. There was slight possibility to whisper, being very cautious. Because constantly you're facing same four walls around you and you can't even look out to the window. Basically, you see nothing during thousands of days. Well, yes, it was difficult. And when we were going to be exchanged, they finally untied our eyes. It was somewhere in Belarus. When we were leaving the plane, it was so amazing just to see a regular green field. And many people around, we've completely lost the habit of seeing such scenery. As we sat on the bus, we simply looked at the countryside, at the trees and the grass.
Things that the average person doesn't notice?
Yes, like that. A lot of guys said, oh, I've completely rethought my whole life. I'm going to do this, that and the other. But I said that we'll all go back to the way we used to live. We're missing some things right now, but it'll pass. The only thing I was afraid of was that I would have a constant feeling of hunger. Hunger was always there. Like you go to bed hungry, you wake up hungry, and you're hungry throughout the day too. I thought I'd never get full, but luckily everything's fine.
Food is one thing. What about satisfying your hunger for information? You went online, watched TV. What surprised you in terms of information during those first few weeks, based on what you learned?
Well, the world has changed so radically. A lot of new subcultural trends have emerged among young people, which really surprised me.
I thought you were going to mention the widespread use of drones in war.
Basically, starting in 2024, we were already receiving this kind of information because new people were coming to us and telling us about it. People who had been taken prisoner and arrived here that same month. From them, we learned that drones were dominating the battlefield. But we couldn't imagine the scale was this vast and that there's actually a drone war going on right now. They were around before too, but not on such a massive scale. You could hide in a trench or a hole and save yourself that way. But now it's very scary and they're all flying right over our heads. Somewhere in the middle of the country, sometimes even over the western part of the country, where it's usually relatively calm.
One of the guys told me that one of the first things they paid attention after return was the dollar exchange rate against the hryvnia. They were interested in that to understand what the salaries were like and whether the economy was stable or unstable.
Well, yes, all that was interesting, of course, but it wasn't the main thing for me.
And what was the main thing for you?
First of all, the main thing was how people are living right now. Like, what the salaries are, what the prices are for certain products, what you can actually buy in stores. While we were in captivity, we didn't know any of this. So both I and the other guys were worried about it. After returning, I found out how things really were. I went into a supermarket myself and saw that there weren't fewer products. In fact, there was much more variety. We thought that while we were in captivity, food was being sent to Ukrainians from Poland or other countries, but the reality turned out to be completely different.
We can send some to them.
And the same fruits, the same vegetables, everything is there and it's all Ukrainian. Meat, yes, it's gotten more expensive, but it's available and people aren't starving. Yes, there are more modest settings.
Just the other day, I came across a video, if I'm not mistaken, two Kazakhs who ended up in our supermarket. They were looking at various products, sharing their impressions.
For butter?
And they were surprised that Ukraine is a country at war. And they had been somewhere in Odessa, I think. Odessa is regularly bombed by the Russians. And there's a supermarket there, so they're in shock that they don't have this in a country that isn't at war, and they're in shock over it.
Well, I was watching them talk. Here's a pack of butter, and there's no magnet on it.
And the price is reasonable. Well, relatively speaking. Subscribe to the channel, give it a thumbs up, and click the bell icon so you don't miss the next episode. During the time since you got back, have you gotten any new tattoos?
Oh, yes. I only had this arm covered, which they beat me with there more than once, or lesson, and that's what we called it. And when they started beating us, we'd say, oh, we're getting lesson today. And now it's almost completely done. I'm finishing up the arms. I've already finished the chest.
And there's still a tattoo on the leg.
Yeah, there have been a lot of sessions already.
I take it you've been catching up.
Yeah, I've always wanted to, basically. I like it. Tattoos, that's how I express my vision. I really like it. Right now it's Japanese style. And I have them on my legs, on my back, and a lot on my chest.
Listen, did you mark this time in prison on your body in any way, or do you want to do that?
I don't want to. I won't. A lot of the other guys have talked about doing that. But, well, honestly, I don't want to bring it up or have it reflected on my body in any way. It's very, very vivid in my mind, and I remember it. And I think that's enough.
Enough scars?
Yeah, I won't forget this, that's for sure.
You said that because of this hand, you were beaten there repeatedly. Is that why, at some point after the beating, the guard said he had the same tattoo?
Yes, that happened. From the very beginning, they beat all the guys for any tattoos. They would ask, oh, what's that you've got there? Actually, they didn't care what was tattooed there. They didn't understand any of it anyway. They acted like they were so pure, like they weren't like us, because a tattoo is for life. The special forces guys themselves, they actually have just as many tattoos and they have them too. I'm telling you, there was this one special forces guy there who 2 or 3 minutes ago was beating up the guys for having tattoos and then asked, oh, what's that you've got there? Oh, Polynesia. I got one just like it. Well, yeah, cool. Good for you. Why are you trying to convince us that this is bad?
Well, first of all, they probably have instructions to do so, and second, they're taking the initiative themselves.
Yeah, on their own too. They're doing a really good job. They think that if we have tattoos, it's bad, but if they have them, it's cool. From their perspective, that's great.
Yes. If we try to summarize, you've had 1,138 days starting from April 12th. What percentage of those days, roughly, did you not get beaten?
I remember probably two times. Well, really, there was Easter Sunday, and what was it? Basically, they beat us with batons every day when we'd go out into the hallway for inspection. So we had to remind them that they were supposed to hit us to give us a pill. There was a special phrase, comrade commander, permission to take my pill. That's what they called it. And then one of them, a guard, would grab a baton and just beat us on the ass, every single one of us. He'd hit us with full force. After that, there were huge bruises, just big lumps. And that day, the guard on duty says, well, today's a holiday, so today there's no pills. Wow, how so? And that's how it was. So that was 2 days in total. In a years of 2024 and 2025, this is the 23rd, I think. And the 24th, no, the 24th and the 25th.
and the rest? So you were beaten for 1,136 days, and there were 2 days when you weren't beaten?
Well, yes. I mean, every single day. There wasn't a single day when they didn't beat us during the morning roll call, except for those two. They beat us constantly, some days maybe a little less intensely. They'd kick us around, use a stun gun, shocker. They used the stun gun probably on half of those days. Yeah, there was a stun gun. It was a constant thing. Every day, one of the guards would walk around with a stun gun and shock every prisoner with it. It was mostly a special forces guys, because the other guards didn't have stun guns. And he'd walk around like that and shock people wherever he wanted. They beat us to any part. He might hit you in the back, in the side, or in the lower back. And many times they tried to hit me in the groin and on the testicles with the stun gun. They didn't even look at it.
A friend of mine who was also in prison there in Russia, and he told me that, whether it was him or someone else, they were literally beating him with a stun gun right in the ass. I mean, right inside. And the guy was climbing the wall. He says, I saw what it's like to climb the walls from the pain. Because it kind of pushes you out and you end up climbing the wall.
Yeah, it happened. So there were days when they would start the inspection at the edge of the hall. And then, let's say, to reach our cell, that they had to pass through 10 to 12 cells. Right at the start, the stun gun was charged. I didn't realize how hard it hits. I mean, when it hit us, it was very painful. It really wakes you up. So much so that you'd be climbing the walls, you'd fall. Sometimes people would just fall so hard they couldn't get up. And there were such days when they started with us. And our cell was the second or fourth to be inspected. And that's when I realized how those guys usually feel, the ones who are always first. And they're almost always first. In the beginning, the stun gun is fully charged. By the time it reaches us, it's already like that. Maybe half charged. And when it's fully charged, it just knocked you off your feet completely. That's for sure. This is for sure. Oh.
And this, as I understand it, is a large veterinary stun gun.
Yeah, a hefty one with three of those spikes. We usually would be standing there face to a wall, arms back, palms facing out. And this used to happen. Well, I don't know. There are no scars left. He'd just stick it right into the palm. They would use the force to do it. It wasn't just that he touched it and hit it, but he pierced the skin with it. It would happen like that. Blood would flow and it would be boil, causing burns. That's how it was. They stuck it into our hands, into our legs. Here was a guy, he was on trial. His name is Nazari Moroz, a guy from Kyiv, a Marine.
Mm-hmm.
When he came back from the interrogations, he smelled strongly of burnt skin. They were just destroying him. He had so many scars on his back, neck, shoulders, arms, legs. He was covered in it. These scars healed very poorly. We were emaciated. There was nothing in our bodies to sustain us in any way. That's why these wounds healed very, very poorly.
Let's go back to these rough statistics. Out of 1,138 days, how many days did you eat normally?
Well, the results were a little better here. They took us out to work one day. We worked on the roof, removing the old roofing, and they gave us food for that a little more. When we worked, they fed us right there on the roof. I'd say they gave us decent food, about three times more than we usually were given in the cell.
And was the food itself decent?
No, well, it was mostly fat, and there was a time, probably about 8 months, when they only gave us buckwheat. We called it the buckwheat diet. Well, it's just buckwheat. All the time, for everything. Breakfast, lunch, dinner, buckwheat. Well, buckwheat is basically mixed with water, you know, with some kind of buckwheat husk in it. And then there was the same thing, only with potatoes. It was dried potatoes. Maybe boiled, I don't know. It wasn't salty, it had no taste at all. The only good thing is that it's fatty, very fatty. But it was more or less nutritious.
So you call this a normal diet, this buckwheat diet, right? Or what?
No, well, it was more like mashed potatoes. That was more filling.
So just potatoes with what? Mixed with porridge too?
No, it was just potatoes.
Mashed potatoes?
No, well, it was kind of boiled or maybe stewed. It is hard to tell.
Okay, they served some kind of meat or fish, right?
There was fish for dinner, but it probably wasn't fish. It was some kind of mockery. Because there were cells for two people, for four, for 10, for 16, for six, but each cell got the same amount. So it was like a ladle, and it was like, I don't know, we called it a kitten fish. It's like, I don't even know how to call it, just some kind of fish. Sometimes there were just fish bones. Sometimes he'd just scoop up some minced meat
Was it boiled potato?
Hard to say. It's just weird potato. And there are eight of us there. And it had to be divided somehow. But there's basically no time to divide it up. It was the same with the bread. They cut one loaf of bread into 15 pieces. It was a small loaf, like a brick. And the slices were probably smaller than a pinky finger. Sometimes it happened that one slice might be thin, the thickness of a cigarette, and another a little thicker. So there were eight of us there. They gave us eight of those pieces, and they were all different. We understood that this was done on purpose, to cause some kind of conflict among us. Yeah, because hunger drove people to the point where they simply could not handle emotions.
Out of 1,138 days, how many did they adhere to the Geneva Convention in relation to you?
Not a single day. 0 days? Zero. Completely. Zero. Not a single one. They played it for us on the radio a few times, so we'd listen. And we sat there and we didn't understand why. Why do we need this? Because they said one thing, how it should be, but in reality, they didn't even follow a fraction of it.
So maybe they did it on purpose, so you'd realize they don't care about any international laws.
We understood exactly that they didn't care at all, and not a single day went as it was supposed to.
What kind of torture did you personally undergo?
Beatings were standard, especially during the first year when there were constant interrogations. But basically, it was electric shocks. It's shockers. The special forces themselves broke my arm.
How did they break it?
They just twisted it so that I could reach my right shoulder with my left hand behind my back. It was just dislocated, and it stayed that way for over a month. I could not move it, and nothing was done about it.
Then there wasn't a single medical examination.
No, I didn't even say anything, because if I had, they would have broken my other arm too. And you can even see now that my shoulder is a little droopy. Well, you can see it, basically, when I'm standing. It's a little noticeable. I've lost a little weight now and started working out, and it's evening out more or less. More or less. Then there were the shockers, the beatings, threats. They threatened me with a knife to stug me, said they'd gouge my eye out. There were various forms of torture.
Did you witness any sexual violence?
Well, I don't think I witnessed anything explicitly sexual. I don't think so. But when I was talking to the security service of Ukraine, they asked the same question, and I also answered no. So they asked me again, did you ever have a stun gun shoved up your ass? Well, that's exactly what happened. I replied that it had happened, but I hadn't thought about it in that context.
As far as I know, even if you were forced to strip naked and they do something to you while you're there, that's already sexual violence. This is it. Well, according to international standards.
Well, they made us all undress. They constantly threatened everyone that they would rape us. Yes, threatened. All the time.
Well, I know they have this thing, often at least I hear these comments, that they're obsessed with this sexual topic, saying something like, I'm going to fuck you right now.
I'm going to make you suck. They say, you're all gay faggots over there. And of course, they used to think that they're so straight. They all say that they love women over there. Everything's normal. Everyone is normal. Just talking about that all the time and calling us faggots. But for some reason, none of us repeats all the time, he wants to fuck another guy. And for them, that's the theme for every day. They constantly talk about it.
Constantly, every morning. And
every day, you guys need to get laid. You guys... No, dude, it seems to me that the problem is not in us. Most likely it is in your head.
Whoever talks about it is the one who's worried. For the first month, a month or two, let's say, torture is applied to you because they want to get some kind of military intelligence. Further, a year, two, three, what is the point of using torture? How do you answer that question for yourself, or did they perhaps say anything about it?
They enjoyed it. They themselves, of course, didn't say that, did not voice it, but we're not that stupid, maybe even a little smarter than them. And we understood. They were rotating, the military and investigators were rotating. So it was like that. Their military prosecutor's office representative would come and they would gather information. They gathered information. They beat us up. They shocked us with stun guns. They asked where I'd been, what I'd seen, where everyone was, everything. Everything was recorded. It could have lasted a week. It could have been six times, but twice a week. And that would be a month. 3 months later, others would arrive. Other people, just other people. And they would start all over again. The same thing. The never-ending process of interrogations. And for you, it all repeated the same way. I kept saying, that's it. I don't know anything. I'm mobilized. I don't know. They didn't care. All shit would be repeated.
Could you give example of something they didn't do to you but did with others? Something out of Raw or even there? Did you hear or see anything?
They tried to avoid was hitting you in the face. But I know people who were with me in the cell. The guards had this wooden board, special wooden board, and usually they used it to hit you in the ass. But this time, they completely smashed the guy's face with it. I mean, they just beat his face to a pulp. The second man, Misha, who used to be a good friend of mine, we became very close while in captivity. Unfortunately, he was on that plane that was shot down in Kursk and died. To him, they took him for interrogation. Well, it seemed like everything was fine. But when he came back, his hand was burned. He had damn baked hand. And there were iron marks on his back, like in an iron. He said that the guards put an iron on his back right from the start. He felt it was hot and burning, and he was laying with that iron on his back. But Misha was tough. He didn't even say anything and he didn't scream. He said he was holding on, but then he felt that things were bad. Luckily, they stopped for a reason. His cape, his jacket just started burning. The guards didn't like the smell of this. So they told him to pull out his hand, and he just held out his hand. The guard put the iron on his hand, and he just put the iron on his hand, just like that. And he had a big burn covering his whole hand.
How long had he been in captivity by then?
Well, that was during the first year, roughly the first 6 months.
So he didn't have any information left that could be extracted from him there and that would be relevant?
No. Moreover, he's a border guard.
And the method from the so-called 90s, back then it was widespread in Russia.
You think 90s. For them, the 20th century isn't a thing. They are stuck in deeper past. 21st century? No way. They still think same way as in USSR. They are raised with this concept in mind. Well, not really growing up, more like degenerating. They remain there in the past.
Have you witnessed or heard about someone there, whether at the Priyomka procedure or just in prison, died, perished, or was killed?
Well, they beaten us in the kidneys and in the lungs, various vital parts of the body. As for the guys who died, well, again, we know about that. We've heard, because all this information was being passed around the cells. I wasn't with those guys, but I know that five men at least died of tuberculosis. Yeah, it happened. The cases were so advanced that a person simply didn't stand a chance. One man spent a year in solitary confinement, in a punishment cell, a whole year. They even tried to feed him something better, but he was already refusing. He knew that he was dying. He was feeling very bad. He was spitting blood all the time.
And why was he kept in solitary confinement?
He was in pain for some reason.
Oh, and was that some kind of insulation?
Yeah, that the guy was terminally ill. Maybe he had hepatitis or something. Well, I don't know. Well, the guy died, that's for sure.
And they didn't exchange him? He just died there and that was it?
Yeah, he died there. I know for sure it was in Yelenivka. They killed the guy right in front of us, just with a single blow. Well then, as they said, it was those guards themselves who hit him and a blood clot broke loose. The guy just collapsed and they say it was a quick death. It seems like maybe 5 to 10 seconds, but depending on how the guy was writhing in pain during those 5 seconds, no, it wasn't an easy death. I can only guess what he felt. But in Yelenivka, one guy was definitely beaten.
Those who died of tuberculosis, did they arrive already having tuberculosis or did they contract it there?
They didn't have it before. They didn't have it because in principle, everyone was healthy on the mainland. There was nothing, absolutely nothing. Also, the tuberculosis literally broke out probably almost a year later.
And what were the conditions like there, conducive to tuberculosis?
The conditions were really awful, unbearable for it. There was mold and constant dampness. We'd sometimes ask them to let us open the window. It was so damp. Water was constantly dripping. The walls were just wet. Not just a little bit here and there. Drops were running down, dripping onto the bed, onto everything. It was leaking so much. You need to imagine worst Soviet quality. That's how it made. It's not just about repairs. Everything there is damp. Everything is rotten. And that's a good conditions for tuberculosis. Plus, it's constantly stuffy. There's no ventilation. Nothing works because it simply can't work physically, given how old it is. It just physically can't work because of its age. And on top of that, in winter, they forced us to open the window, but not in the summer or just during the warmer months, not on warm spring days when you want some fresh air or just ventilate the room.
So you opened the window in the winter, but what was the temperature like in there?
Oh, there were harsh winters with temperatures as low as 30 degrees Celsius.
Below zero?
Below zero, of course.
And inside your cell?
Well, I wouldn't say it was even slightly above freezing. It was only because some warmth was coming from us.
What kind of clothes did you have?
Just a regular jacket, like one we wore in the army. They were probably a little thicker. Yeah, it was a jacket, regular pants, and a work shirt.
Nothing insulated?
Just regular work clothes, a t-shirt, underwear, those kinds of pants, and a jacket. Well, we called them jackets. It's like that.
Which prison was this?
It was in the Smolensk region, the city of Vyazma. Detention center number 2.
And those were the conditions there?
Yes.
Were there any inspections? Did you ever go to them or not?
Well, the inspection is just, it was usually expected. They prepared for it. It's literally like that. The inspection is going to arrive at 10 a.m. The morning check goes by the book, like regular one, with all the beatings and mockery. At 10 o'clock, maybe someone could arrive. For that, they could change the sheets for us. And that's it. Because they knew perfectly well they've intimidated us so much that no one will dare to complain. I could not say that I needed anything. For a year and a half, they wouldn't even give us simple things, like a toothbrush or toothpaste. They gave us a little bar of soap a month, which we were supposed to wash with. The water was only cold. Not just a cold, it was freezing. It felt like ice or boiling hot, what would make your skin peeling like that. But we still washed, bathed, and tried.
I think there was a time when the International Red Cross came, and you asked them something about a letter.
Yeah, some representatives showed up. Well, they looked like Red Cross representatives because someone like them was meeting us previously. Well, supposedly. Here's how it was usually. I am from the International Red Cross. Any questions? Nah, nothing there. Everything's fine. End of story. And then these guys showed up. We've got them in our cell. Two guys. Well, they introduced themselves and started asking questions. So it looked different. And it seemed to be real. We're not standing there with our backs turned. We can see them. People are talking to us. And so they ask, oh, do they let you write letters here? Yeah, of course they do. Any questions? I didn't see any problem with asking the question. It looked normal. The guys were talking to me. They looked open for talk. Well, I guess I can talk to them. I've already written 5 letters there, but I haven't received a single one. Tried to explain this issue, hoping they may handle it. And one of them seemed to be writing something down, saying it's okay. Okay, we'll try to do something about it. Well, okay. And they left. An hour later, our cell door opens. Special forces storm in. Fucking idiots. Who told you you could ask any questions? And that's when we got 60 days of additional beatings. So regularly, during morning check, you've got stun guns, you've got constant beatings. Yeah, they beat the shit out of us. And additionally, we got hits with a sledgehammer.
For asking for a letter.
The whole cell, there were 8 of us in the cell, but, well, I was the first one to ask. They even told me, Ivalak, who the fuck do you think you are? What the hell were you thinking? I was scared and could not get it. Like, I was not asking anything special about food or any medicine, even though there was lack of it. No, nothing special. But I saw an opportunity to ask about my family. I decided that I'll take a chance here. And there you go. Well, obviously, it didn't help in any way. Only one thing happened. Everyone in my cell just got beaten up.
Did the guys take it in stride or were they mad at you?
Well, yes and no. There were guys who understood it. There was a person whom I thought would not support me. But he also said, it's no big deal. Well, okay. But there was this one guy who started to complain. We've been getting this for a week now. We're all getting it. It hurts so bad. Oh my gosh. And there was another man with us. He is 62 years old. He's an officer from our brigade. He was in really bad shape, but he didn't even say a word. He's an old man. He was getting it and said, it's no big deal.
And he was beaten the same way?
The same?
The same.
And another one, also an officer. This is a guy who, in my opinion, isn't worth a damn.
You don't have respect for him?
I don't. This is a guy who showed his worst side. Like, he started whining and I said, well, excuse me, but what am I supposed to do? Do you understand that I didn't do this on purpose? I didn't know it would turn out like this. The guys there were understanding. But why should I be responsible for you? He complained. Well, sorry.
You're one of the few people who, when filling out the questionnaire I sent out earlier, specifically mentioned the issue of disinformation. You said that was one of the hardest things for you, that they tried to mislead you with information, influence you, and lied about what was happening in Ukraine and so on. Can you describe a bit what exactly they did and why it was psychologically difficult for you?
Well, first of all, we knew that situation at the front line is complicated because, as the example of Mariupol showed, they don't care about people at all, that they don't care about people at all. For them, destroying a place is a piece of cake. That's what they're able to do, what they are good at in general. And it started, I guess, about 3 months since we arrived there as prisoners. They started telling us about the losses our army has, quantity of vehicles being destroyed, and the numbers were just so high, it looked like a doomsday for our country. But we started to doubt it. They said, we destroyed 700 of your planes.
Where did we get 700 planes? We don't even have that many.
Even more armored vehicles were destroyed, up to 3,000. That's probably including cars, bicycles, everything.
According to their statistics, I think they've destroyed 22,000 tanks and some armored vehicles in Ukraine.
They were feeding us with all that information. It's not like some random guy just showed up and is dictating things. It's not a regular guard who announces all that shit. This is a person who knows how to do this. And this is a more sophisticated way of influencing our minds, the loss of lives. How many of our guys have already fallen? That's the bigger issue. The numbers were plausible, cause based on what I saw in Mariupol, all the losses in there, and that's a lot. And I realized that it might true. That right now, our guys are just getting killed over there.
And were you scared because there might be some truth to it?
Yes, it was scary. They also said, oh, Kherson is ours, we've taken Kherson. We're already reaching Odessa. And what about you guys from Kyiv, who was in Kyiv? I lived there until mobilization. That's it, Kyiv is gone. They said that they dropped a tiny bomb. And Kyiv is gone. I mean, I get that this is a country with nuclear weapons and they play crazy and they are morons. But what if they did it? Because if someone doesn't give a damn about the whole world, he'll do whatever he wants.
I understand that the only source of reliable information was the other prisoners who arrived later.
Yes, the ones who came later. That was probably the second year of captivity.
Did they ever put you all in one cell or in different ones?
Yes, it happened every 6 months. We were all shuffled around. It was a hectic day. It was a hectic day. We called it Kipish. It was a whole day of running around. And every time you're sitting there, and it's genuinely scary when the door opens. When the door opens, not for scheduled inspection, it's really scary. Because with an inspection, I already know I'm about to get beaten up. And I somehow mentally prepare myself. But when your door opens unexpectedly like that, it can be even worse. And that day, people run around. They started transporting people from other colonies, from pre-trial detention centers. And then we started asking questions to each other. When did you end up in prison? I was there since 2023. How's life outside in Ukraine? Mobilization process goes on. Some guys are going in their own will, some not. What's with this thing? Everything is fine. And what's with that? Everything is fine. And in Kyiv, parties in the clubs and house supplies in the stores, everything is fine. Everything. Also, they really like to show us videos of these, as we say, busification things. Obviously, they picked out moments like that, like something maybe was made up there. And you watch that. It's scary, yes.
So even there, they showed you how recruiters were catching young men on the streets here.
Yeah, they said, like, look, if you go there now, they'll send you back to the trenches. They won't give you a minute to rest. What do you think will happen to you there? I say, well, we have a signed law because those returned from captivity have rights in Ukraine.
Did you already know that there?
Yeah, we knew. And again, they said, that's not true. Listen to me, that's not true. There were some very small exchanges, and they're right there. You know there was an exchange, so they are already all dead. I reply, why do you think they are dead? Guard says, well, they just arrived. They were literally washed down, checked over, and sent straight to the trenches. You're like traitors. You've been captured. Nobody needs you. You're immediately on the losing side.
Well, it's kind of funny in a way, in the sense that that's exactly what happens to them, basically. But they're accusing us.
Yes, and we more or less understood that it all was a lie. But, well, still, it kind of creeps in. New guys would come and say, yeah, there's a mobilization. But yeah, there's a mobilization. But you know, it was 2022 when all of it started. The recruitment centers were overflowing with volunteers. There were no such buses stories like now. Nobody was looking for anyone. There just wasn't a way to process everyone. In a single day, people were standing in lines.
They stood in line all night. Some people paid bribes to join the armed forces. I know stories like that.
Yes, starting from 2023, 2024 year, it changed. There are some who just can't do it. And there are people who are simply, well, genuinely incapable of going to war or using a weapon. Not because he's not a man or he's not a patriot. It's just that some people are like that. And they are definitely not needed there.
If you like this story, please leave a comment, ask questions. We'll be happy to respond. And by doing so, you'll support our project. Please tell me about the radio.
That's probably the scariest part.
Practically every prison has this radio that broadcasts propaganda. How was it for you?
That's the first thing you hear, and it's all over the place. And the craziest part is that they listen to it by themselves. They hear it too, because it was so loud, and it's playing right there in the cell, in the hallway, just everywhere. And they listen to it by themselves. And these songs, just some Soviet ones, from 30s, 39, these propaganda songs from the days of the Red Army, like Arise People's Country, even now if I'd hear it, makes me feel sick, honestly. This one song played nonstop while they were processing us, while they were beating us up, while they were ransacking the cells. It just kept looping for 24 hours straight, and it gave me chills every time it started playing. It's so crazy, man. And it was also on the very playlist. They played there every day. It was there. There were like maybe 30 of those stupid songs, and they played them on repeat all day. Well, it helped us figure out how to track time. Now we could do it, not just by the sun, and as we couldn't look in the window regular, we used shadow to make marks. So when it was at some point, we knew the time. Yeah, sometimes we just heard talks of the guards, and they were talking about time. We just needed to mark it somewhere. Morning check starts. Yeah, it's about 8 a.m. At some point we hear, behind the door, what time is it now? Guard was talking to regular prisoner, asking when the supper starts. He needed to know. And we caught it once. Yeah, now it's 8:30 a.m. We marked it on the wall where the sun was at that point. I put a mark for myself. And from that, we knew time by that. The guards are literally stupid, just idiots who know nothing. And there was a funny situation. One of them came into our cell and talked to me. You know, what time is it now? I say, well, we don't have a clock. Oh, come on, he says. I know you know. Guess, really, I won't do anything to you. I say, somewhere around 8:45 a.m. He says, it's 8:46 a.m. He was surprised and asked, how do I know? I replied, how? Checking starts at 8 a.m. And by the time you get to us, it's been 6 minutes, maybe 10 per one cell. Well, something like that. For them, it's, mind-boggling because they probably never thought of that before.
For them, it's advanced math.
Yes, we used every trick in the book. We used them for ourselves. Against them, we could tell just by the voices, by their shoes. They lied to us. That moment, one could say we are good. But I knew that he was the one at the check who beaten me up that day. He would just pretend to be good to us like it was someone else who beaten me that morning. But I knew that it was him.
An extended version of this conversation is available on Patreon, where you can subscribe and thereby help us translate this conversation and many others into other languages and accordingly achieve a greater impact for a wider audience. So basically, we can move on